We have some very exciting news for you. The IAP Essentials podcast is starting to move towards some new and exciting content. To match that change, the podcast will now be called The Special Edge Strategist. We hope you continue to listen and find value in our podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Special Edge Strategist podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based support, educational therapy, academic therapy, and IEP coaching by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. The Special Ed Strategist podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs and the IEP process.
Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, the podcast that offers all things special ed. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you're new to our podcast, give us a follow. I cannot wait to have this conversation today. We are talking with Dr. Rebecca Resnick and talking about the mechanisms of working memory. So I'm very excited to have Dr. Resnick join us in this conversation. So welcome, Dr. Resnick. Dr. Resnick is a licensed psychologist who specializes in neuropsychology assessment. Her practice, Rebecca Resnick and Associates, has two offices in North Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Resnick currently serves as president-elect of the Maryland Psychological Association. Prior to becoming a psychologist, she earned her master's degree in special education with a concentration in learning disabilities. Her book, A Family's First Guide to ADHD, was published in 2016. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Resnick. I am really excited for our conversation about the mechanisms of working memory. So welcome.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be here. Particularly getting the chance to talk and hang out with you is a lot of fun.
Oh, I appreciate it. And I love that you have a background in special education that is going to really excite our conversation here. So I have a lot of parents, and just through my years as a special educator, reading a lot of reports, both asking the report stating and parents asking about working memory. So let's start off, how is working memory different from short and long-term memory and even sensory memory?
That is a great question, because if you get your kid tested, you will invariably, as you scroll through the report, see a little WM for working memory, and you'll see a number beside that. And we often interpret that number as meaning something that it really doesn't. So working memory is not what it is in a standardized test. In a standardized test, it's how many digits can you remember? How many pictures can you remember? How many sentences can you remember? Can you tap a series of blocks on a grid, remember position of dots? None of these things are real working memory the way we think about it in neuropsychology and neuroscience. So working memory is not just holding little pieces of information in mind. It is really a cognitive workspace. And that idea came out of Virginia Berninger's work. So this cognitive workspace, you can all think about it as, you know, either your work table in the garage where you build things, or maybe your counter space, whatever works for you, you do you. But that cognitive workspace is where we hold information in our conscious attention long enough to perform a task. Whether that task is driving to work, making pancakes, solving a quadratic equation, we have to have that cognitive workspace so that we can bring up the information we need, right? The recipe for pancakes, the quadratic equation, whatever it is, and work on it long enough until the task is actually done, hopefully. And then we put the information right back into storage. Brains are great that way. At any given moment, I can ask you to pull up all sorts of fantastic information, like how do you apply Orton Gillingham? How do you cook pancakes? How do you solve a quadratic equation? And we can pull these information up, use them, and then put them right back into storage. And that capacity to hold information in our conscious attention is really what working memory is all about.
So let's talk about this cognitive workspace, right? It really, as you're explaining it, my idea of kids with ADHD, anxiety, trauma, executive function, and I know I'm probably jumping ahead of a lot of questions here, But I love that idea of a cognitive workspace. It really makes it a visual for folks to really grasp onto and help better understand the idea of working memory. So what are some important skills or behaviors that utilizing working memory come into play?
Pretty much everything. So if we're thinking of working memory as using that cognitive workspace to pull in what we already know with focusing on the problem-solving task with the information that's coming in. That's information that we hear, see, feel. It can also be information from our bodies. Am I hungry? Am I tired? Am I annoyed? Am I happy? All of this gets put onto the cognitive workspace. And cognitive workspace, it's time limited. You may have heard people talk about how there's the speed and the span of working memory. So we have to process information pretty quickly because our brain is going to pitch it out, right? We've always got to clear out information space in our counter space or else we run out of capacity and that's when we get forgetting or distractibility. So as we get older, everything counts on us having a bigger counter space, having us being able to hold more stuff in that space. So the very first working memory task that we all have is learning to, well, for those of us who hear, is extracting meaningful signal out of the speech that we hear all around us, that garbled acoustic signal. We have to start chunking up information and recognizing patterns. And that's what we're doing when we're babies. Let's fast forward to first grade, and this is where you live, where kids have to start developing that insight that letters go with particular sounds and that more than one sound can map onto the same letter. They have to start learning their decoding. They have to start that process of orthographic mapping where they're matching phonemes, you know, sounds onto the graphic representation words, and then they get the sight word vocabulary. After about third grade, working memory capacity needs to be really good because these are the years when we start expecting kids to have a lot of stuff under their belt, a lot of tools, if you will, so that they can do a lot of advanced problem solving. So for a lot of our kids who are neurodiverse in some way, whether it's ADHD, learning disabilities, autism spectrum, anxiety, their cognitive counter space is either taken up with a whole bunch of other stuff, or it's just not holding as much in the problem solving space. So our sort of one size fits all education program that we have is counting on this sort of neurotypical cognitive workspace that we expect kids to have. Well, if you don't have that, or you didn't get the chance to clear all the stuff out of your cognitive workspace, or maybe your cognitive workspace is all being taken up by these tiny little tasks that you were supposed to learn how to do, but you didn't. Let's pull this back to the pandemic for a bit. A lot of our kids missed out on really important foundational skills, things like their basic math facts, their decoding skills, their sight word vocabularies, their spelling, their sentence writing. And so let's fast forward to like third or fourth or fifth grade. These are the application years, right? If you don't have all of those tiny little skills under your belt where they're completely automatic, your cognitive workspace is not adequate to handle third, fourth, and fifth grade demands and beyond, because we're talking about not just recognizing that an A can make five different sounds in English. We're talking about reading a chapter book. We're not talking about, you know, your little fact families anymore, you know, 5 + 5. We are talking about long division. We're not talking about being able to write a simple sentence about a picture. We're talking about composing paragraphs and text. So the working memory demands often get really intense before a lot of our neurodiverse kids are ready to handle that.
So you've brought up reading a couple of times, and it's my passion and love here.
Yes,
in this world. How does students that are identified with dyslexia, how does the working memory come into play?
This is such a great question. I don't know about you, but I was trained in whole language in the 1990s. And as most of us know, the fallout from the reading wars is that whole language, you know, by all research studies that we have, as much as we young teachers loved it and embraced it, the research has shown us that whole language really caused our reading proficiency scores to tank in a big way. And phonics instruction, as Mark Seidenberg has said, it didn't go away, it was outsourced. It's now behind a paywall. If you want really amazing brain-based reading instruction now, you often have to go to people like you, Wendy, at Learning Essentials and pay out of pocket for it because the schools are no longer offering it. So the way that we think about working memory and reading, it really comes into play in terms of how automatic the basic reading skills have become. Whenever anything becomes automatic, we can do it without thinking. That means it doesn't take up our cognitive workspace. So if you think about driving to work, you can do that and listen to NPR and maybe have a phone conversation or grab a sippy cup that fell on the floor of the car. You can do a whole bunch of stuff and you're basically on autopilot. And so all of your brain bandwidth is freed up so that you can do different stuff while you're driving. Well, for our kids, they need to have all of the basics of reading completely automatic. You don't want them decoding every single word. So if they come across a word like bake, for example, I know you know all of this, that the kid who in third grade is looking at the word bake and having to go, there's a silent E there. Okay, silent E. That means that the A says its name. So, okay, so this word is not back or beak, it's bake. Okay. All of their cognitive workspace was just taken up with decoding and trying to access everything they need to solve the problem of decoding that word. For our dyslexic kids, they don't learn new words in 1 to 4 exposures like your typical kid does after third and fourth and fifth grade. They may need 10 exposures. They may need 20 exposures to a new word before their brain completes the orthographic mapping process. And then they recognize it without having to stop and decode. So our dyslexic kids are working so hard on the decoding process that all their brain bandwidth is taken up. And so they're slow and they're clunky and they're frustrated. It's painful to watch them read. And what we know about the brain, right, is that it has limited bandwidth. And we know your bandwidth is taken up with decoding. You don't have time for comprehension. There's no cognitive workspace left for understanding, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or The Snowy Day or, you know, God forbid, some Jane Austen or Shakespeare or something like that. So our dyslexic kids are coming at those consolidation years of elementary school when they need to have all their cognitive workspace freed up, they're coming in with a big disadvantage. And this is why we often see bright kids hit the wall in about third grade.
Exhausting. Yes. Exhausting. Yeah. It's exhausting for these kiddos, for sure. You know, so how is working memory related then to recall? Because we're talking about reading, we're talking about driving, we're talking about a lot of skills here, but how do those two come to play together?
So recall is when your brain is taking something out of storage. So there's no like one particular place in the brain where we have all of our memories. It's still debated as to whether or not memories are stored in the synapse or are they in dendritic spines. If you ever want to have a super geek out, pull up the podcast Brain Inspired and you can listen to neuroscientists, you know, having these big battle royales over where memory is. But the point of that is that we don't have like a cup full of memory. Memories stored all over the place. And some brains are really good at getting to that information. They have it stored in a neat, tidy container store style alpha shelving system. And other kids' working memory is kind of a dumpster fire and finding the information is really challenging. So when you have to work really hard to find the information, you don't know where it's stored. It could be stored up in very unhelpful areas where your brain can't find it all that easily in the moment. It's really hard to pull up the information you need to put on your cognitive workspace. So if we think about math for a minute, think about when you're in fourth grade and all of a sudden you have to solve a long division problem. If you can't recall, you know, all of your basic facts, not only do you need your addition facts, you need your times facts, you need your single step division facts, you need your subtraction facts, and you have to remember the steps in the algorithm, which to most kids makes no intuitive sense whatsoever. And so they have to put all of this together. And so recall is all about pulling up the tools, pulling up the information, the pancake making recipe, the map that you have in your brain to work, how to change a diaper, how to solve quadratic equations. All of that information has to come, get properly activated and get to the cognitive workspace in the moment that you need it. So all the trains have to run on time. For our neurodiverse kids, a lot of times when you're watching them problem solve, it feels like when you're in an airport and you look at the list of when your flight has been delayed or it's on time, and you see that there's been a volcanic eruption in Iceland, all the way over in Iceland, and yet all the flights all over the world are grounded or late. Well, brains are a lot like that. When you have problems in one area, it means that all the other places where information needs to get, when it needs to get there, get messed up as well. So you don't have just like one particular brain area. It's about all of these circuits working to get everything you need to that cognitive workspace at precisely the right time that you need it.
Wow. So can we improve working memory? So if we're looking at kind of this train track analogy or airplane analogy, you know, and you think about kids with trauma in the brain, you know, concussion or some sort of anxiety or anything that impacts them, can we improve working memory?
We absolutely can, but not in the way people think. People think that improving working memory often has to do with a lot of types of drilling activities or practice type activity. That's really not how we do it. Let me answer the last part of your question first, because as a special educator, that's near and dear to my heart, is thinking about all of these kids with learning differences and what happens for them. So if you remember, we talked about the speed and the span, right? How quickly do you get all the information where you need it to be? How quickly do you process information? And how much information can you hold at one particular time? You can think of it as juggling. If you're juggling two balls, that's a lot easier than if you're juggling 10 balls. So our kids with learning disabilities are oftentimes slower to pull up the information that they need. They may need prompts or cues to even know what kind of information they need to pull up. For our kids with ADHD, they're struggling with just getting their attentional spotlight focused on the right place so that they can clear off that cognitive workspace for the next task. The other piece that comes up a lot for kids with ADHD and anxiety disorders and autism spectrum disorders is a concept in neuroscience called interference. And interference is basically when information gets shoved out of the cognitive workspace because something your brain thinks is more important popped up. So if you're trying to do a long division problem and all of a sudden you look over and that super mean girl bully is giving you the stink eye and passing a note to her friend about how lame your outfit is, you're no longer paying attention to your long division problem. Your brain has decided, uh-oh, there's something much more dangerous to pay attention to in the environment. You know, girls are scary. So for our autistic kids, they're often so overwhelmed by their hypersensitivities, things like buzzing fluorescent lights or the sound of the scraping of chairs or other kids chewing or the feeling of how uncomfortable their clothes are, or just how exhausting the school day is. All of these things cause interference. They cause information to get bumped out of the cognitive workspace and the bandwidth gets sucked up by something else. So a lot of times our kids really want to pay attention. They want to please us. And so what do you do when your cognitive workspace is getting bombarded with stuff that doesn't belong there? You often try to rush. And so we have a lot of our kids who try to slam through their schoolwork as fast as they possibly can, because it's like they're carrying this big stack of plates and they have to run to keep the plates from falling. So a lot of our kids are trying their best to compensate. Some of our kids are trying to rush. Some of our kids are slowing way down because they're so perfectionistic. They don't want to make a single error. And so they're, you know, not even getting started when everybody else is finished. And back to your first part, how does working memory get improved? The way that we really improve working memory, there's kind of two big ways we can do it. One of which is we can reduce stress. Because stress is a bandwidth hog. We have decades of research telling us that too much stress sabotages our working memory system. It hijacks our cognitive white space and it takes it all up with whatever worries that we have on our mind at the moment. And our brain is designed to pay attention to stuff that's dangerous and troubling, right? We come from a long line of people who ran away when there was a mountain lion chasing them or grabbed their toddler before it fell into a stream. This is a good system. It's adaptive. But when you're talking about learning stress, it becomes toxic and it really interferes. So our kids with learning difficulties, of course, they are much more stressed. At school, they're running up a mountain with a cinder block attached to their back while everybody else seems to be running up the mountain much faster. And the teacher is saying, like, you're lazy, you're stupid, do your work, focus, all of these unhelpful things that we say to kids. So our best way to improve working memory in terms of cognition, like really clearing out that cognitive workspace so it can hold the most stuff, is we have to teach our basic skills to the point where they're totally automatic. And this is where people like you come in, because you have the tools to teach those basic reading skills to the point where they're not just sort of there a little bit and they're very fragile. And maybe a kid can get through their Fontes and Pinel assessments and sort of fake their way through by guessing in those early years of elementary school. What a really skilled tutor or teacher can do is help these kids get all these basic skills to the point where they're totally automatic. Automaticity is what we need for fluency. And when tasks are fully automatic, we have this beautiful, wonderful, gleaming counter space where we can work. And when a kid's got all their basic skills under their belt, totally automatic, that's when you can bring in the higher level order tasks, things like writing term papers, solving complicated equations, reading a more complicated book. But none of that can happen before kids get all of those basic skills under their belt.
So the reducing the stress to improve the efficiency of working memory is really ensuring that these skills are automatic. Is that the correlation?
And getting special ed, people don't often think of that as a mental health intervention, but it really is. We can accommodate until the cows come home. You know, we can try easy, quick fixes like, oh, let's, you know, no longer time the kids' test, or let's give them all audiobooks. Let's give them a scribe so that they don't have to worry about handwriting. And the problem with this is like that old proverb of if you give a man to fish, he'll eat for a day. If you teach a man a fish, he'll eat for a lifetime. And as Trevor Noah said, if you give him a fishing pole, then you're really helping him out. We need to think about education that same way. Accommodating is a little band-aid that gives the kids some working memory boost in the moment, but it is not a long-term fix. And what we don't do very well in this country is give kids the kind of intensive brain-based intervention and instructions like you do at your practice that really helps them get those skills completely automatic and make sure that the information is going to stick. We have a lot of kids who learn something sort of just enough. And I know you see this in your practice all the time, right? The kids who, they learn it just enough. They take the test. Maybe they have a chance to go back and redo the test, which is a terrible habit. And then what happens in, of course, a spiral curriculum, the information's gone a couple weeks later. I see tons of high schoolers, and I bet you do too, who when I give them a mathematics test, they can do the stuff they learned in like the past couple months. So they can do a couple algebra problems, maybe a geometry problem if they're lucky, but to save their little lives, they couldn't get through those sort of basic math tasks of like late elementary school and middle school because they never really understood it. It didn't become an automatic task that they could just pull up out of their stored memory and access and use on their cognitive workspace. The brain said, I'm not using this. I'm going to dump it. And brains evolved during our history when most people didn't have enough to eat. Most people were starving or on the verge of starvation throughout most of human history. So brains had to get really pretty. They had to get pretty tough about what am I going to keep and what am I going to dump? Because we've only got so much space in the brain, so much real estate. So brains are really quick to get rid of stuff that they don't think are useful or stuff where you don't have enough circuits getting excited by the stimulation. The brain is like, nope, I'm done. I'm clearing that out. That's obviously like a closet full of clothes that don't fit anymore. I'm going to get rid of that. So we have a lot of kids who don't hang on to the information long term, and the teachers will be very puzzled. Well, I taught that and he got a B on the test. So why is it that now he can't do it? Why is it we checked that off on the IEP as like a goal? You know, oh, we met that goal. Well, did you go back a few months later and reassess and figure out, did you actually meet that goal or did you sort of get close but not really convince that brain? You got to hold on to this long term so that it's always there right whenever you need it.
I like that you brought up IEP and accommodations. I have been, Dr. Resnick, at many IEP meetings.
Bless your heart.
And really have kind of had this conversation with teams and even parents that separately outside of an IEP meeting about accommodations and what can we do to support our learners to have that automaticity? What can we do to support our learners so that they have skills to help with their independence? And what creative solutions, what can we put in place how can we thread learning together so that our learners can become more independent in their skills, and that, you know, there are accommodations that make sense, but there are also ones that, if you think about it, it's like, how can we teach this student to get their homework written down? So maybe it's not in writing. Maybe they're going to do speech to text on their phone with like Google Notes or something of that nature. So anyways, I'm digressing of our conversation of working memory, but I really am glad that you brought that up for anybody that's listening, if they can kind of think creatively and how we can infuse what we're doing for that independence for our students so that they can become lifelong learners and independent and future employment education, as well as it is to the law.
Yes. And not living in a basement smoking pot when they're 30. Absolutely. Yeah. And I was a special ed teacher, and having been on the other side of that table and seen sort of what goes on when you're a parent in an IEP meeting, as you know, Wendy, what you're actually seeing there is like the tiniest tip of the iceberg, where you have school policies, budgets, staffing shortages. You may have a school that's gotten inundated with a whole bunch of kids who are really high needs. You may have people on that team who don't like each other or have like a particular bias against a parent for whatever reason. You know, maybe they don't relate well with parents of color, or maybe they're underestimating students of color. Maybe they just, you know, they think, oh, this parent, you know, so difficult, such a helicopter parent. There's so much going on there that really gets in the way. So in terms of that basic question of how do we get kids independent, I love that, because it's like the hokey pokey, right? That's what it's all about. Just accommodating kids through, or getting them to that sort of just enough zone so that we can check off a goal on an IEP, that's really not education. I mean, our whole education system in special ed, we're set up towards satisficing. And satisficing means that you're doing the least possible, the least amount of special ed possible to get, you know, those goals checked off so that you are in compliance. And so we are often just sort of putting paint on the problem or a Band-Aid on a wound instead of stitching it up and shoving the kid along. And so we do run into a lot of kids where it seems like they're getting help, and the school is saying, oh, we have all these supports in place. We're doing response to intervention. We're doing accommodations. The kid has a scribe, whatever. And yet this kid is not making progress. Well, part of the reason for that is, I'll say it this way, is middle-aged people. And the reason I say that is because I am 48 years old, about to turn 49. And when I was trained in getting my special ed degree, we had big time shiny object syndrome. We were always chasing the new trendy thing, whether it was whole language or constructivist learning or, you know, experience-based things, you know, whatever the new style was what schools were buying and was what teachers were trained in and what the mentor teachers were teaching. Well, here's the problem. All the people my age are now the leadership team. They're the people who are in administration. They're buying curriculum. They're mentoring the younger teachers, their faculty. And so a lot of the things that didn't work have become enshrined in our public education system. Things like whole language, the three queuing method, for example, scads of research. We know this doesn't work. And yet you will still run into teachers who are really wedded to this, you know, because it's how they were trained. So the big answer is that we need to get brain-based educational techniques into our schools. And most teachers, there's a huge gap between what they're asked to do on a daily basis. And people like us in private practice, I mean, you and I can go to conferences, we can read journals, we can, you know, take really cool training webinars, but that information about what's happening in the research community doesn't always trickle down. And so you have a lot of teachers who you know, don't know better to do better. You can't give what you don't have. So the real answer is for people, you know, like you and me and parents to advocate very strongly for these brain-based methods of teaching, you know, like phonics, for example, multisensory math, really making sure our kids get the basics. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but it is, nothing changes in education until a whole bunch of parents stop taking no for an answer. I loved your little video that you put up on LinkedIn, the one where it was, you were shaking your finger. And
Yeah.
What did you say? Like, don't accept wait and see. Was that how you put it?
Correct. No, wait and see is not the way to go. Ask a lot of questions. I always ask parents to help encourage parents to ask a lot of questions, sometimes be the squeaky wheel to unearth what is happening in the classroom and trying to figure that out, which really kind of leads me to my next question. How would, you know, we're talking about what working memory is, but how would a parent or a teacher pause and think, I'm wondering if the working memory of my child is not working?
Okay.
What are some like red flags? Mm-hmm. Are there red flags?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And yet you and I wouldn't have jobs if there weren't a lot of red flags for sure. So one of the signals that kids will use to communicate to us when they're not getting what they need, when they're not getting their support needs met, is behavior problems or avoidance, uncooperative behavior, or a lack of motivation. All of these things are the symptoms. We do wrong when we start punishing kids or giving them labels. And I mean labels like you're lazy, you're unmotivated, you're dumb, you're, you know, oh, you have all these mental health problems, so you can't possibly learn. You know, those are labels. And they're labels because people slap them on our kids when they don't have information that they need.
Kind of to what you were saying, I you know, kids don't wake up wanting to be a jerk.
No.
Right. So they're giving us that information from what they're saying or from their behavior. You know, kids are not just waking up in the morning thinking, I'm just going to be a jerk today.
Yeah. As Dr. Ross Green puts it, every kid wants to be the one with all the gold stars. Every kid wants, there you go. I love, Wendy just held
I just showed the book, Lost at School.
Lost at School by Ross Green, particularly for me as a special education teacher, you know, now neuropsych. That book is such a revelation about what we're doing wrong for our kids. You know, we are so quick to punish and judge instead of listening and putting on our detective hats and trying to figure out what is getting in this kid's way. How do we get this kid on a path where they can taste success? Because Rick Lavoie, if you remember him, one of the great special educators, he said that we think that if kids work hard, they would try harder, but that's backwards. They'll try harder if they actually get some success. You know, we need to feel like what we're doing matters and that there's a reward and that people are going to be proud of us at the end of the day.
But isn't that how we are as adults as well, right? You know, if you're in a working environment, you want to feel like you're doing your best. You want people to recognize that you're doing your best, not, you know, have a Macy's Day parade over our little wins, but just to, you know, you want to do better when you feel like people are watching and accepting and, you know, it makes you feel good. So
absolutely.
It's that cycle.
Yeah, that when our... when our humanity is embraced and we feel listened to, when we feel like we matter, that is the most motivating thing in the world. That will outperform any stupid sticker chart that you can come up with. You know, shaping behavior, it's all about teaching skills in the context of that holding environment of love and validation and, you know, and of acceptance for who people are and that belief that there's a better model out there and that we can, you know, that we can get our kids along this path and help every kid realize their potential, no matter what that is. You brought up a really good point about the red flags, and everybody listening is probably like, hey, get back to the red flags. So one of our big red flags is when our kids don't seem to be learning either as quickly or as efficiently or with as little stress as their peers. When you're seeing a kid with working memory problems, you're probably seeing a kid who has attention problems. And it doesn't mean they can't pay attention. ADHD is like a terrible name for what this actually is. It's a problem of attentional control, not that you can't pay attention, because we all know that we can all pay attention to things that are really exciting and pleasurable. You know, kids can play 4 hours of Minecraft, but not get through a worksheet. Well, how does that happen? Because it's all about where their brain is shining the attentional spotlight. Where can they keep their focus? Anybody can focus on something that's highly stimulating and super fun and very rewarding. No problem. But when we see our kids who are really just struggling, they don't feel good about themselves, they're not getting their work done on time, they're not starting their work, maybe they're showing us some uncooperative behavior or they're starting to give up, or you notice that when they come home from school, homework time is torturous for these kids. the teachers only see, you know, your kid, if you're in a public school, it's your kid is one of 30. If your kid's attention is fading in and out and they're not throwing chairs, how are you as a teacher really keeping track of that? Especially for our kids who don't get on anybody's nerves. Dr. Sam Goldstein, the attention researcher, always talks about how our kids need to get on other people's nerves, at least three people across three different settings for at least 3 months. He called it the rule of three. If our kids don't bother other people, or worse, if we're looking at that kid and for some reason we're underestimating that kid, maybe because they're a kid from another country, a second language learner, a child of color, these biases are still very much alive in our education system. And if we're not paying attention, we miss it. For our kids, we're often seeing that their self-esteem plummets right kind of in the middle of third grade. You can almost set your watch by it. Third grade and sixth grade and ninth grade.
And you're right. Third, sixth, ninth are really where we get our phone calls.
Yeah. And this is where the working memory demands go up stepwise. They don't go up gradually. They go up big time. Like all of a sudden, you know, we're going from picture books to chapter books. We're going from writing sentences to paragraphs. We're going from sitting in one classroom all day where you know the routine and you know where all your stuff is. And then all of a sudden it's, okay, now you're in a brand new building and you got six different teachers and you've got to manage a locker and a backpack and different notebook organization strategies for every class. A lot of our kids are not ready to do that. Like chronologically, they're there, but the working memory demands way exceed what they're ready for. And this is when, you know, we got to identify the support needs and get these kids the help that they need so that they can keep going instead of falling behind. These are really our danger years. Like first grade too, but third, sixth, and ninth, where our kids, they can't jump up with the rest of the class and adjust to this really quick change in our expectations, they can really get off track very quickly.
How does working memory thread into executive function? Because that's really a lot that we're talking about. And Learning Essentials, we offer our camp is called Brain Camp. And it's just a way to teach students who they are as learners and strategies to apply so that they can be more successful in their learning environment. So how does working memory go along with executive function?
So executive function, as far as the brain is concerned, neuroscience defines executive functions as any goal-directed activity of the brain. So a goal
very broad.
Yeah, very broad. A goal-directed activity can be a cognitively oriented task. It can be a physically motivated task. You know, you're hungry, you get something to eat. It can also be an emotionally related task. You're in pain and you're frustrated. Maybe you fight back or run away or decide how you're going to cope with those circumstances. Executive functioning is too often thought of as being just about cognitive processes like attention and working memory. But what we're learning in neuroscience now is actually really exciting. There's a huge emotional component to what we pay attention to, what we put on our cognitive workspace, how we remember information, what helps us recall information. And of course, when we have stress, anxiety, depression, trauma in the mix, which a lot of our kids do right now, we are in this echo pandemic where levels of stress are through the charts. I've never seen anything like this. But all of that interferes with our working memory. Executive functioning is any goal-directed behavior, and that can include learning, doing things, remembering to do things in the future. Working memory is just a part of that. And the sort of foundation of all executive functioning is our attention system. And our attention system is diverse group of circuits in the brain that are talking to each other all the time. So you have the brain is constantly monitoring what's going on with the body. You know, am I hungry? Am I tired? How excited am I about this? And the prefrontal cortex, this part of your brain behind your forehead, the one that solves problems and is carrying out a lot of these problem-solving, goal-oriented types of tasks, is constantly getting bombarded with way too much information. So successful executive functioning is really about ignoring most of the stuff that's going on around you. Ignoring the fact that you'd rather be doing something else. If you're, you know, in school and it's not recess time, you have to ignore the fact that you're desperate to get out there and run around. You have to ignore that maybe you're feeling anxious. You have to ignore that you're hungry and it's not time to eat yet. Or maybe you have to go to the bathroom, but your teacher won't give you a pass because, you know, they only give out two per semester, whatever. So with executive functioning and working memory, it's not just about like, oh, there's this working memory center that does working memory stuff. Working memory, again, is that cognitive workspace. So you have attention shining the spotlight. So what's even going on in your cognitive workspace? You have to identify what information needs to get pulled up and put on your cognitive workspace to solve the problem. And then you basically have to be able to keep that information and focus steady. Because as soon as you take your eye off the ball, as soon as your brain shifts that attentional spotlight or something interferes, it all falls apart. And then you have to start all over again. An important thing for parents to know is that we do not multitask. They may be distracted by what's happening in the classroom. They might be insisting that they can listen to music or respond to text messages while they're doing their homework. They can't any more than you can text and drive. We all think we can, but we can't. So keeping that cognitive workspace as clear as possible so that we can keep our attentional spotlight focused on where it needs to be focused on, pull up the information we need, keep it in mind long enough to actually solve the problem. And then there's that other piece that is really essential, the self-monitoring piece. How do you know when you're done? How do you know you did a good job? So we have to be able to visualize at the end of our goal-directed behavior, did this meet my a priori standard? And if not, what do I need to do to make sure that I get my task completed? For a lot of our kids, the working memory issues are that they run out of gas before they ever get their task completed, or they're working from sort of a faulty assumption about what the task should be like. You know this when you see a kid who sits down and they're supposed to write a paragraph and they write like one sentence and they say, okay, I'm done. And you say, no, 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 this was supposed to be a paragraph. And they respond with, but I can't write anymore. I can't think of anything else. So again, their little cognitive workspace, the speed and the span were off, right? They were processing the information way too fast and not self-monitoring. Did I do a good job? Is this going to be what my teacher is expecting? Is this actually a paragraph? Having that ability to visualize and take perspective and evaluate the task is also part of it, because working memory can't clear out the cognitive workspace until the task is actually done.
I also liked earlier that you brought up the emotional component part of executive function, but just even, you know, keeping into consideration that as a whole child and supporting the whole child. And as an educational therapist, you know, that is our goal, is to support the whole child, both cognitively and emotionally. And so it really is interesting that that element that you mentioned, the emotional component, and how we as educators and parents really need to kind of keep that in the forefront, especially coming after a pandemic, like you said, and that impacting us as individuals, as humans, and as learners, for sure. So what are some best study suggestions or methods that you have for students when it comes to working memory?
So for working memory, one of the biggest things you can do is reduce the stress level. And I think you mentioned that you're one of two certified educational therapists in the entire state.
In the state of Maryland. That is correct. So it's really big on the West Coast, and hopefully we can get some more folks trained through the Association of Educational Therapy. So I am, yes, one of two in the state of Maryland. And I don't think there's really many in surrounding areas as well.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And you know, for us, as one of the few people who's been a special educator, been on the other side of the table, reading those cruddy reports. And now I'm, you know, it's my job to take the neuropsych hat and perspective and try to take what I learned about all of special education and how kids learn and what it's like to lead kids through a curriculum and sort of wed that with the neuropsychological. That's where the fun happens.
And the match made in heaven.
Well, or in hell. Depending on the day.
Depends on the day.
A big piece of that is really embracing that we don't have this idea of a prefrontal cortex is like, oh, this is your Mr. Spock brain. It does calculus. It does your taxes. You know, it does logical behaviors like computer programming. Everything we do cognitively has to do with our emotional state at the time. Our body and brain are constantly communicating about our emotional status. When our stress level is high, there is a direct negative correlation between how, when our stress level is too high and how our working memory falls apart, how our executive functioning falls apart, how our attention is shifted inward so that we're paying attention to our worries or anxiety. A worst case scenario for that is when you have like a full-blown panic attack, when your attention is directed inside to your anxious thoughts, even when you're in a completely safe environment. For a lot of our kids, they are just too stressed for them to be able to learn and consolidate memories. Stress interferes with your attention, your working memory, your memory consolidation, how you put the emotional tags on the memory so that you can pull them up when you need to. And your self-concept is really important as well. I know people think of the idea of self-esteem as like this 70s touchy-feely granola idea, but your self-concept is extremely important. If your brain doesn't believe that you can achieve a goal, it doesn't set off those nice dopamine pathways to get you motivated to do something. We learn very quickly what we have the power to change versus what we don't have the power to change. And unfortunately, if you have a kid who's been bumping their head against the wall for years trying to learn how to read, and it's never happened, and everybody else is reading, and they've got the label of the dumb kid or the lazy kid or the, you know, the sped kid who's never going to make progress, yet that sinks into your soul. And it's really, really hard for a brain to get motivated to do anything when that brain has learned and hardwired in based on experience after experience after experience that you can put effort into this, but it's not going anywhere. And your predictive system just says, okay, you can put effort into this, but it's just going to be horrible. So let's put our effort into something else. And so we have kids who, you know, by the time they're even getting to school in the morning, they're already checked out, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where they fall farther and farther behind. And as educators do, once again, we are very quick to blame the kid or blame the parent and not ask ourselves, what are we doing wrong? How is the system failing this kid? How is my instructional program not meeting this particular kid's support needs? And so again, when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, we're very quick to either go with sticker charts or punishment, or God forbid, even the worst thing is we take these kids' recess away. Yeah, that always
don't get me started.
Right?
Don't get me started.
That's one of my big things that I really hate. Or, you know, we put them in a timeout room, you know, we suspend them. When has suspension ever improved a kid's behavior or helped them develop the skills that they need to overcome? So it, you know, we do all of these things just because they're like baked into our system and they're habitual patterns that we all fall back on. And the more stress we get, the more we fall back on these little routines and habits without really thinking very critically about, does this have any evidence base? Does this support, or is this in line with the research about how we know that brains learn and function? And if we ignore the emotional piece, then we are missing out on one of our very best tools to help kids make educational progress. Because the more pleasurable and exciting learning feels, you know, that is when we tap into all the things that our brains find really rewarding. Our dopaminergic system kicks up, our serotonin kicks up. All of these things are really important for learning. They're not just feel-good chemicals. When our brains are in this mode where we are actively engaged and curious, we're feeling the right amount of stress, the right amount of challenge, that's when we learn. That's when we make progress.
So that positive relationship. Having a positive relationship. And then are there any other little kind of low-hanging fruit that you could share with either for parents or educators that they could implement into as they're teaching or supporting their student with homework? What are some things that they could do to support that working memory?
So one of the things that we don't tend to learn about when we are training to become teachers is how kids learn and how kids can study. And I wanted to bring up the work of Dr. John Dunlosky, D-U-N-L-O-S-K-Y. And he has a really great article out there written for teachers. If you Google John Dunlosky in Toolbox, it will come up. He wrote it for the AFT. Basically, Dunlosky is a super duper expert in studying. And for our kids, once they hit, you know, third, fourth, fifth grade and beyond, then a lot of their learning and consolidation has to happen outside the classroom. Homework should no longer be guided practice activities or things that kids, you know, really haven't encountered before. Homework is really about developing automaticity and fluency and nothing else. We get homework wrong. Well, part of homework is studying. And a lot of our kids, particularly with ADHD and learning disabilities, they're using study They don't know how. They're using study strategies that don't work. A lot of adults do too. And our brain can fool us. We think they work because we're working hard, you know, but that's
got to work smarter, right?
Work smarter, not harder. That's exactly that's like the mantra. You just like paint that above the door of my practice and yours too. So yeah, if we know how brains work, we know how to study, and we know that
particularly your brain, right? And that's what we do, you know, with Learning Essentials and Brain Cramp, is providing that education, how brains work and how you as a learner individually work. And then let's look at some strategies that best in sync with your learning patterns and make sense to you.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, if
sense to a kid,
they're not going to do it.
They'll do it while they're in your office. Sure. You
know? Right. But I mean, I can't go in their back pocket for the rest of their lives. So I want them to independently employ the strategies in the classroom and then outside of the classroom so that they can have those skill sets that they need to be successful.
Yeah, that connects up with that really important theme that you brought up a couple of times about how do we make them independent so that they're not always needing a tutor, so they're not, you know, God forbid, needing a parent leaning over them every night. And then you get the power struggles and the whining and the tears and all of that. So in terms of the study strategies that kind of work for everybody at the meta level, I'm not talking about the individualization that you do at this point, but we know that people need to study in short bursts. People need to mix up the content instead of studying, you know, like the same 10 spelling words, you know, over and over and over again. It helps to mix it up with other chunk words, for example. We also know that our study strategies have to be active. We have to be challenging our brain to pull up the information out of storage and put it on the cognitive workspace and do something with it. If we're doing passive studying like reading or highlighting, those things maybe don't work. Why? Because our cognitive workspace, we can put the information on it, but the brain's like, whatever, you know, and just pushes it off to the side to make space for the next thing. We're not like hanging on to it. Another thing that people really underestimate is sleep, because when you're talking about working memory, brains take in information, they will process it for a little bit, and then your brain has a decision to make. This is called complementary learning theory. Either I'm going to chunk this up and make sure that I hang on to it, or I'm going to get rid of it. And remember, brains are very stingy with their real estate. So if people aren't sleeping, particularly our high school kids, if they're not sleeping, going through the full set of sleep cycles, you can study until 3 a.m, but you're not going to get the benefit out of it. Why? Because your brain gets depleted out of the neurotransmitters that you need to learn. And then you don't go through the sleep cycle, which is where your hippocampus and your cortex are working like mad to figure out how to consolidate all the information, put it in storage neatly filed, so that then the next day you have it. And so our kids will often do like this marathon cramming, which is just about the worst thing you could do. You want to sabotage your learning system, stay up all night cramming, and then take a test. That's like the perfect way to do it.
So what learning difficulties or disabilities are closely related to working memory?
Everything. Well, because all of our learning difficulties impact the speed and the span. They make it harder for kids to process information efficiently. They make it harder for kids to connect up the information with the old information to build that automaticity and fluency that is the rock upon which we build our church, right? It's that foundation so that we have cognitive workspace freed up. So whether you're talking about dyslexia, whether you're talking about autism spectrum, anxiety disorders, intellectual disability, ADHD, all forms of neurodiversity mean that there are differences in terms of how the kid's attention system works and how their working memory system works. Some of these differences are really beneficial, you know, put in the right situation. For example, if you remember Dr. Michael Curry, who was featured in the movie The Big Short, and in the book The Big Short, he is an autistic person who was extremely good at honing in on tiny, tiny details. And he was able to predict the economic fallout of 2008, if you remember that. And he said, a neurotypical person never could have done this because I have that intense focus. Well, that intense focus is great when you're Michael Curry and you're an adult and you can do whatever the heck it is you need to. That intense focus and not being able to shift your attention away or pay attention to stuff that doesn't feel meaningful to you, that's really difficult. And if you're like a third grader or a ninth grader, where you're expected to learn everything, whether or not you're good at it, whether or not it interests you, you just got to do it because somebody else decided you have to. So we have this one size fits all approach to education that doesn't serve these kids very well.
What are the different elements of working memory?
So when thinking about working memory, there are subsystems. And remember that what gets to your working memory comes out of storage, and it also comes from the input. It comes from what's getting in through your ears, through your tactile sensations, through your interoception, through your eyes. All of this information gets up to the cognitive workspace, and your brain can either pay conscious attention to it, or your brain can block it out or gate it. Remember, attention is mostly about ignoring. So your brain has two kind of subsystems that it uses to manage the incoming stream of information. One of these is the phonological loop, which takes care of holding on to a few seconds worth of auditory information. As I'm talking, you are processing the stream of auditory information, but a lot of comprehension actually comes from you're making a prediction about what I'm going to say next. So if all of a sudden I say orangutan right in the middle of our conversation, your brain does what's called surprisal reaction, where you're saying, wait a minute, statistically, orangutan was not predicted to come next in this particular sentence because we're talking about executive functioning. Very central to mathematics is the visual sketchpad. And this is your brain holding on to visual information. Now, the advantage of visual information in terms of your brain's information processing is that visual information tends to stay put. Auditory information decays instantly. Once it comes in, it's gone. Visual things tend to stay put. We're very visual animals. You know, like a dog is mostly about, you know, what they smell. For people, we are really about what we see. And so we've got these kind of two streams where we've got our phonological loop holding on to just a little bit of auditory information at a time, our visual information, we're seeing something, we're holding on to that image for just a little while. And if both of these systems are working well, we can hold the information on that cognitive workspace long enough to solve a problem. But again, if we have some kind of problem with the input not coming in a clear way, maybe it's garbled, maybe our attention system didn't shift over quick enough for us to take in all the information we needed. Maybe we weren't looking where the teacher thought we were, you know, look at the Promethean board. Well, maybe we were looking out the window or at the cool little thing that we put in our desk that we smuggled in that day. It's very easy for these systems to function suboptimally. And one of the biggest problems, of course, is distractibility and interference. Anytime your attention gets hijacked or knocked off course by something else, these things go completely out the window. So for a lot of our kids with ADHD, you'll see them and they look like they're listening or they look like they're looking at the board, but you have no way of knowing where their attentional spotlight is actually shining.
So how is working memory linked to standardized testing? Or is it?
Yeah. Linked? So standardized testing is a fact of life now, ever since George Bush Sr. put into place the whole Goals 2000, which was basically where the government decided that instead of giving schools money, they were going to force schools to change through accountability and sort of threat-based interventions. This drove a lot of us out of teaching, where they deliberately decided, okay, we're going to have schools teach to the test. And so our kids spend a really awful amount of time taking standardized tests. Now, some of these are useful because some of them are actually measuring things about our child. When we think about our kids with learning differences and our kids with neurodiversity, standardized tests are very tough because we're taking them out of the context. We're taking them away from all of the cues that they need to pull up the information out of storage and get it to their cognitive workspace. And we're putting them in this very artificial, sort of structured, stripped down type of assessment situation. And these standardized tests, they have to be made really, really easy to score. And so if you make something that's super easy so that you and I and 1,000 other people would score it exactly the same way, it almost has to be so removed from the actual true nature of the task that it's almost not even got the validity to assess what the child really actually has to do. A lot of our kids will take standardized tests in the early years and do okay. And a lot of that has to do with their compensation strategies. Some of it has to do with, you know, that they've either memorized some things or maybe they recognize a couple sight words. The domain you're sampling in the early years of elementary school is really pretty tiny. And by domain, I mean all the knowledge you're supposed to have to pass this test. So some of our kids will sort of get by and score in the average range. And then the parent will come in and say, you know, Aiden can't read. And the teacher will say, oh, yes, yes, he can. Look at these MAP scores or look at these Woodcock-Johnson scores that the school psychologist gave. And the parent will keep insisting. And what do they think? Oh, look at this difficult helicopter parent, just so anxious. But the parents know what they're seeing and they get silenced or they get told, oh, he's just a boy, wait and see, or, oh, we have to try RTI before we can actually do anything else. Absolutely not true. RTI is not something that you have to go through like years and years of it if it's not working before you can try special education. A lot of parents.
So RTI is response to intervention.
Oh my goodness, you're right. RTI is response to intervention. And Maryland is an RTI state where the idea is really great one. When Fuchs and Fuchs came up with this back in the 90s, the idea was, why make a child wait to fail? Let's intervene and help, you know, as soon as we can, give the kid whatever they seem to need. And that's great. The problem is that in the operationalization of it, it means that a lot of kids are waiting way too long before they're getting assessment and before they're getting supplementary aids and services, IEPs, the special in the special education. And unfortunately, again, this is why we need people outside of schools, because a lot of these kids are not getting what they need, you know, from the school, or they're waiting until a little problem snowballs into a big problem. Then it's like, oh, look, you're eligible now that you're failing. Well, you know, I'd much rather fix a small problem than wait for a problem to get way out of control and then have a kid who's frustrated, feels dumb, and is no longer motivated to try very hard because they've learned there's no point.
Amen. So how does that relate to IQ, working memory?
Yeah, working memory and IQ are very closely tied together, because IQ in the way that we think of it in the world of psychology, IQ is really the general problem solving ability. How do you take information that you already have and use it to solve problems? Or how do you come up with creative ways of solving problems that you've never seen before? So there's this idea in an IQ test that you want to assess how somebody uses their crystallized knowledge, their background knowledge to solve problems, as well as how does somebody come up with new and creative solutions. Remember, on IQ tests, just because there's a working memory index, that's really assessing just their span for rote information. Working memory is the foundation of all problem solving, because remember, problem solving happens in this cognitive workspace. It's all about working memory, being able to hold ideas in conscious attention. So you have people like, say, Richard Feynman or Albert Einstein. These were brilliant people who had huge spans. They could hold a lot of information all at once, really complicated information. And so this is why they could use their cognitive workspace to solve problems that are much too complicated for a lot of us. For our kids with disabilities, sometimes they have a very small cognitive workspace, and we have to step up as teachers to make sure that we are giving them the multisensory instruction, the cueing, the prompts, so that they can use what their working memory is to the very best of their abilities to solve problems as well.
We talked about stress impacting working memory, right? And so how does that, whether it's an internal stress, external stress, what suggestions do you have for learners with test anxiety?
Right. So I see a lot of kids with test anxiety, particularly our gifted kids who tend to sometimes be perfectionistic in ways that are good, but also ways that really sabotage their attention system because it becomes all about the perfection. And so test anxiety is a really important thing. And a lot of different kids get test anxiety, whether you are a kid who's particularly stressed, whether you're a kid who has an anxiety disorder, or whether you are a gifted kid who tends to get very sort of perfectionistic and compulsive about getting everything completely perfect. The major thing I would say about test anxiety is that accommodation isn't enough. We have a lot of parents who come to see us, and their major focus is, I want my kid to have 100% extended time. Well, just expanding the time doesn't help all of our kids. Now, for some kids who have some sort of slow processing speed, maybe they just need more time to think through things. Maybe, you know, they have speed and span problems, so a little extra time, maybe breaks off the clock. Those things are fantastic for a lot of our kids. But if all we're doing is accommodating, then we're not teaching our kids the skills that they need to manage their test anxiety. And when you don't have the tools, then you're dependent, right? When you're not independent, then other people have to accommodate you. And tests are part of life. You know, the idea that we're going to have 100% extended time to do everything in this world is just not a realistic way to function. So if you have a young person with a lot of test anxiety, helping them develop coping strategies, helping them practice taking tests, like an exposure type of therapy, helping them really practice managing their emotions and calming down while they're taking a math test, while they're taking a practice SAT, so that they get to the point where they can do it even in the midst of being really stressed. We often try to treat anxiety with like once a week therapy session. And sometimes the skills that kids learn just don't generalize out of our office and work their way into the classroom, for example, particularly for our kids on the spectrum. So one of the really important things to do when you have a kid with test anxiety is teach them coping strategies, teach them relaxation strategies, refocusing strategies, and also teach them how to take tests. It's a skill, and it's a skill worth investing in, whether you're talking about a fact families test for a first grader, or you're talking about learning how to take the MCAT, these things aren't going away. We might as well really dig in and learn how to be good test takers.
Dr. Resnick, I could geek out with you for so much longer. I mean, just the wealth of knowledge and every question that you've brought and answered, and it's just has been quite a pleasure. As I'm wrapping up, what should I have asked you that I didn't know enough to ask?
For you, really not much, because you know you have this background as a special ed person. You've been on the other side of the table. You have your own kids. You run a business that is responsive to what the community needs that the schools aren't providing. And you do that very creatively as well. Honestly, I think we really covered everything there is to cover. So, you know, in terms of takeaways, I would really tell parents that if your child is really struggling, just like you said, don't take wait and see for an answer. Don't take he's just a boy. Don't take stop being an anxious helicopter parent. If you know that your kid is, say, crying during homework time or really not focusing or not making progress, don't be afraid to get some answers. Get some testing done. Get a professional tutor to look at that child. You can go through the school screening process, have the school psychologist run some tests. You know, keep in mind that's generally a screening process. It's not a diagnostic process, but don't be afraid of getting the information. It's much better to get the information sooner and then get the tools in place to do something about it, then wait for a problem to snowball. A snowballed problem that's been going on for a really long time is much more expensive and time consuming to fix than a small problem. So don't wait.
I love the fabulous takeaways. If you could have a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why? As our final question.
Oh God, I think I just said it. So
I think so. How do we put that in a billboard?
How do we put that in a billboard?
Don't let it snowball.
So if I were creating a billboard, it would definitely say, don't let things snowball and trust your instincts.
Oh, 100% trust your instincts. Such a pleasure. Such a pleasure. I will put information in our show notes on how to reach out to you, Dr. Resnick, and how to find your practice and to get additional information. So I absolutely appreciate your time today. And thank you for joining us on the Special Education Strategist podcast. Again, I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Show us some love at Learning Essentials and give us a like and follow. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today for our Special Ed Strategist podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.